welcome to the Inside Myanmar podcast. Before we get into today's show, I want to let you know that we have a lot more written and video content on our website. If you haven't visited it yet, we invite you to take a look at insightmyanmar.org. In addition to complete information about all of our past podcast episodes, there's also a variety of blogs, books, and videos to check out. And we also encourage you to sign up for our monthly newsletter. But for now, enjoy what follows, and remember, sharing is caring.
First of all, I would like to express my special thanks to you for inviting me to be here. And I do hope that we will have a fruitful conversation about Myanmar politics. My name is Dunyaphak Pichalat. Currently, I am Associate Professor of Southeast Asian Studies at the Faculty of Liberal Arts, Thammasat University. At the same time, I'm also the President of the Association of Regional Studies based in Thailand. According to my educational background, I got my MA degree in Southeast Asian Studies International Program from Chulalongkorn University with the financial support by Rockefeller Foundation. Then I got my PhD in Comparative Politics at the University of Hong Kong with PhD Visiting Research Fellowship at Cornell University Southeast Asia Program. My MA thesis is about moving the capital from Yangon to Naypyidaw. It was published as a pocketbook by White Lotus Press in 2009. And my PhD dissertation is about designing federalism and federalization process in Myanmar. And it was published by Routledge in 2023. And the book title is The Politics of Federalization in Myanmar. My area of interest includes geopolitics, comparative politics, international politics, and Southeast Asian politics, particularly Myanmar politics.
We thank you so much for joining us. This has been a long time coming. We've tried to connect for years, and so many people that we've had on the podcast, they always reference, well, you're really the one we have to come to ask some of these questions. And so we're glad that we get to sit down and have to and to ask those questions now. And there are three main areas that we'll be covering on this discussion that will all intersect with each other. As you've just mentioned, one of them is the moving of the capital. Secondly, it's federalism, a big topic and, and incredibly important. And then the third is looking at Thai-Burmese relations. And we will also be linking your books and writings in the show notes. And so I want to call a special attention to listeners that this is just going to be giving a surface level taste for the depth of research and work that you've done. So we really suggest for listeners, if they are intrigued by this topic, to go and learn more there. Let's get started on your first work, which is moving the capital. So so the capital was in Yangon, and as we know it, moved into what was the middle of the jungle in the middle of the night, and what became Naypyidaw. So tell us, give us the background of that.
According to my perspective, I think there are three main factors involving the capital relocation from Yangon to Pieng Mana, or officially Naypyidaw. Firstly, it's about strategic and political reasons. Yangon location is very close to the sea. And at that time, international relations between Yangon and Naypyidaw was not so good. President George W. Bush condemned Senior General Tan Chui as dictatorship leader with human rights violation, and American soldier captured Iraq and Afghanistan, destroying authoritarian regime. So the Burmese soldier might afraid of this scenario, so they try to move strategic area from the coastal area to the hinterland area with mountainous area so that they can conduct guerrilla warfare in the long run, hit in the jungle and fighting back with American powerful air forces in some way by underground warfare. So if you take a look at Naypyidaw topography, you can notice that in the city mountainous area, there have been underground complex, the bunker, and the Myanmar military stay there in the forest. So this is one of the most important reasons for moving the capital in strategic reasons. But if we try to understand Yangon political landscape, it was quite dangerous for the regime because Yangon was the center of popular uprising against dictatorship. So having the new seat of power with the new urban planning systematically might be good for the regime stability. But security and politics, not only the main reasons alone. We could look at hinterland development, because Naypyidaw is located at the center in Burman heartland, so it can connect with every part throughout the whole country. So Naypyidaw now is the new logistical center for transportation throughout the whole country. And in the adjacent area close to Naypyidaw seems to be agricultural heartland for Myanmar development strategy. So it quite makes sense for moving the capital in the hinterland area, comparing to moving the capital in Nigeria from Lagos to Abuja, in Turkey from Istanbul to Ankara. One of the main reasons is having a more central location for hinterland development. But I also look at another reasons, that is socio-cultural factors involved in moving the capital. And I see that Senior General Tan Chui would like to repeat the historical legacy of the Burmese monarch in the past by moving the capital and establish the new powerful seat of power so that his name will be recorded in Myanmar modern history. And at the same time, the Burmese Praetorianism might afraid of colonialism and imperialism in Yangon. Yangon was established by British colonialism. So the soldier with the high degree of nationalism might thought about having a better location with new architectural style in terms of anti-colonialism. So Naypyidaw is the new symbol of Myanmar Praetorian nationalism and Buddhist nationalism. You can see the new pagoda, the replica of Chavedagong pagoda in Naypyidaw, and the white elephant, the symbol of the monarch in the past, have been established because there are many places in Naypyidaw having the white elephant. And even today, not only Senior General Tan Chui, but Senior General Min Nong Lai also have paid special attention to the holy ceremony for raising the white elephant, which is the symbol of peace, prosperity, and the power of the monarch in the past.
There's a lot there. And I think I first came to live in Myanmar in 2007, and I think the experience of many Americans at that time, when we would meet young Burmese, we would have this very curious exchange where you're referencing the first thing you said about the fears of American invasion and Iraq and Afghanistan coming off those wars, there would be a very curious exchange where they would say, why don't you invade our country? We want you to invade our country. You invade everywhere else. Why don't you invade our country and kick our leaders out and do regime change here and give us the freedom that you're promising these other places? We will actually welcome it. Like what you were expecting there, we will actually be the ones to welcome it. And it was this these very curious exchanges of trying to convince young Burmese why it was not in the interests of our country to invade theirs when they were asking for it. And I think this background as well of looking at the monarchy past, I think, is so important because, so as we know, so many kings, a part of like establishing a new reign and a new legacy was in moving a capital. And even in like, you know, 18th and 19th century, there are stories of entire buildings being disassembled and then, you know, carried by elephants and slaves and porters, you know, 100 miles east or west or some direction to be able to set up there. And then the names of everything was important. The name signified things, the statues, the placements, all of that. And so it was somewhat in that line. And I think this is also, you know, for those who are not familiar with Naypyidaw, I think there's a, or if they haven't been, but they've heard about kind of the weirdness and the way that it's been portrayed in photographs or or stories. It is a, if this move was not weird enough, the capital of Naypyidaw is really, really weird because it's like this creation of a mass city in the middle of what used to be a jungle, but the people never came. So there's like, you know, massive hotels that came in with certain contracts because they wanted to show that they had international hotels there, but there was no one to fill them. And the embassies didn't move. That's another thing. So none of the embassies moved. So the capital is in a separate city from the embassy. So you would hear from all these diplomats and other international workers that, you know, they would have to jet back and forth and back and forth to go to these and then to go down the 20-lane road where, you know, they were the only car there. I actually led a pilgrimage for meditators in Burma at one point, and we passed through Naypyidaw because we were in nearby Pimina, which is where the great monk Ledi Sayadaw had passed away. So we were at the monastery where he died and looking at some of that history. And as we went through Naypyidaw, we, you know, many people take their own pictures. We decided to meditate. So we meditated in the middle, sitting down cross-legged in the middle of a 20-lane road, saying that this is probably the only time in our lives we will, you know, meditate on a 20-lane freeway with no cars there. and so there's a lot there with that. And one of the things I want to prompt you on with all that background is there's at least I haven't heard about some of the in-depth understanding of how fortified Naypyidaw is. And there have been questions that have been put to me at times by people looking at the conflict, and I'm not sure to what extent you're able to speak on conflict analysis, but there's been a question of, in the last 5 years, why has there never been a push or a drive to think about taking the fight to Naypyidaw in a serious way? It's when you look at where the conflict is, it's not so far from where Naypyidaw is, and it was damaged extremely in the earthquake. And so I wonder if there's anything you could comment on why, what level of fortification we're seeing and why something like that has never been contemplated.
Yeah, that is a very good observation. I think we should look at Naypyidaw's systematic urban system separated into three main parts. The first part is Piang Mana, the center of population, the center of farmer, the center of merchants in agricultural area of central Myanmar. But there is another area, Naypyidaw Command, the War Office, the Ministry of Defense in Myanmar, situated in northeastern part of Naypyidaw landscape. This is the mountainous area, very fortified. It looks like the iron fortification of Myanmar armed forces. Perhaps we can see some underground complex. We can see the station for guerrilla warfare in that particular area. And the last one is Naypyidaw. In the western part of the Sitong Valley, the Naypyidaw is the administrative capital with many buildings and also many hotels for hosting international conference or seminar. So in urban landscape, the city can be classified into three main parts. This represents in some perspective about security and political reasons behind moving the capital. Very different from Yangon. In Yangon, the center for popular uprising, the zone for dense demographic settlement, are situated closely with some bureaucratic buildings. So it might be dangerous for the dictatorship to command and control the situation in the state of emergency or in the time of popular uprising against the regime. But having the seat in Naypyidaw is better. So let me give you some explanation about two main events. When Cyclone Nargis hit lower Myanmar, Yangon was in a dangerous situation, but the junta stay in Naypyidaw. Mm. So that is the better place in command and control some non-traditional security threat from the sea or from the Cyclone Nargis. Yes, Naypyidaw has the main problem about the fault line, the sky fault line, and the earthquake. But it is very difficult for the regime to look at other locations to replace Naypyidaw, because having looking the strategic heartland sitting in the center midway between Yangon and Mandalay, having a mountainous topography, all of these excellent conditions are quite good for providing the fortification system for the Tatmadaw or Myanmar Armed Forces. So I think for urbanization process, the city design is quite systematic. So if we would like to emphasize that Naypyidaw is the island fortification for the Tatmadaw, I also agree with this. I also agree with it. And in terms of comparisons, I would like to turn back to the Second World War in the Thai case. At that time, Field Marshal Phibun Songkram decided to move the capital from Bangkok to Phetchabun, situated in the hinterland in the mountainous area, having excellent condition for conducting guerrilla warfare. Field Marshal Phibun Songkram evaluated that the Japanese armed forces or the Western armed forces might invade Bangkok, situated near the sea. So having another location for in-depth strategy might be good for having island fortification for the Thai case. So in some case, I think Phetchabun and Naypyidaw can be compared and contrast.
Right. Yeah. So that gives us some really interesting background on when the capital was moved about nearly exactly 20 years ago. And we've seen the outgrowth of that from, maybe there was some effective strategic planning, given the nature of how the transition and the coup and the resistance has developed, that it has gone to help them. From there, let's shift to your work in looking at federalization, which is fascinating. And there's so much there. And as I understand it, you've marked several important dates as to when a version of federalism was possible in Myanmar. If I'm correct, those are 1948, 1962, 1988, and 2011. And so if I can have you to share with our audience some of your findings in these key dates, what was possible then and how it turned out.
Thank you for the question. I think according to my observation, the politics of federalization was debated heavily, especially in the Second Panglong Agreement in 1947. And then Myanmar have the new constitution based on federalism concept. And then under UNU administration, there was some big debate about designing federalism in Myanmar. But in 1962, General Ne Win took power for the whole country and proclaimed that in order to eradicate secessionist politics with connection with federalist politics, the military need to control the whole country and need to cut down or eradicate federal movement in Myanmar. So since that time until 2011, Myanmar was in the dark age in the politics of federalization. The country was governed by unitarianism, centralization process, and the debate about designing federalism was very limited. But in 2011, which is the critical juncture for Myanmar politics, for Myanmar political transformation, I observed that there was three process factors: constitutionalization, democratization, and conflict management, or the peace process. These three factors conjoined together in the year 2011, and then federalization has emerged and developed. Mm-hmm. So it's quite interesting to analyze causal relations between independent factors, constitutionalization, democracy, peace process, and dependent factors, the development of federalism. So that is the main argument in my dissertation, my PhD dissertation at the University of Hong Kong. But since 2011 until 2015, that was the big progress about nationwide ceasefire agreement between Tan Seng administration and ethnic armed organizations. The essence of NCA focused on designing democratic federation for Myanmar. Okay, so at that time, the framework for analyzing federalization in Myanmar depends on stakeholder or political adversary tactic and strategy for designing federalism. So it seems that the causal factors, the three process factors, have already pushed the re-emergence of federalization in Myanmar modern history. But since 2015 until the big conference about the 21st century Ponglong Conference under Aung San Suu Kyi administration, NLD administration, the peace process come to appear as the main mechanism for pushing federalization in Myanmar. But at the same time, military conflict and confrontation on the ground, the fighting between the Tat Mador and ethnic armed organization is another factor for pushing the trajectory of federalization. But since Senior General Min Nong Lai took control over the state 4 or 5 years ago, there have been the stagnation of federal trajectory in Myanmar. But NUG government have tried to establish a federal democracy charter aiming to design a more systematic bottom-up federalization in Myanmar. So at this moment for today, we need to look at federal phenomena in Myanmar closely. It has already been stagnant, but it has never been eradicated, because the main agenda for opposition group, NUG government, and many ethnic revolutionary organizations still stick on the politics of federalization.
There's so much there in that description, and I think the first thing I want to hit upon, I'm recalling a conversation I had with Henning Glaser. And who is an expert on constitution building. And in our discussion together, he cautiously expressed quite a pessimistic view as to where he saw the ability to bring these groups together. And he was, this is not one of those outside observers that's sitting on a perch and critiquing that, you know, you're doing it all wrong from a privileged place. His center has been involved in supporting and helping in many ways, and there were some good positive developments that he could point to as well. So he wasn't simply a naysayer, but he did give and apologized in doing so, give a rather pessimistic view of any possibility that he saw of being able to bring groups together to find an aligned vision that would have them go forward. One of the ways I pushed back with that is I had mentioned that for all of the work being done on top-down solutions, there's incredible work being done in bottom-up ways, and for some of the failures that we saw during the 2010s of kind of enforced top-down solutions that never really caught on, there seems to be a lot of great examples of bottom-up governance that's taking place, and bottom-up solidarity, and groups being able to, the youth generation especially, being able to connect in solidarity in ways we've never seen. So one of the ways I pushed back when I spoke to Henning was to ask him to what degree is a federal democracy charter actually absolutely necessary if you start having bottom-up solutions that are taking place. And Henning's view was both pessimistic in terms of the possibility of where you would bring people together, as well as absolutely insistent on whatever's happening bottom up, that this charter needs to be in place. There's no real hope of anything unless those things are firmed at the top. And so I contrasting these views and bringing his perspectives on, I want to get your thoughts on where you see that we're at right now.
According to my perspective, I think Myanmar state building project is very complicated. The concept of federalism is very useful for designing the state, but it is not sufficient from now on, especially since the coup by Min Aung Hlaing, because Myanmar political topography is much more complex. And I think it can be divided briefly into three main parts. The first one is the Burman heartland with the seat of power in Naypyidaw. Senior General Min Aung Hlaing have tried to centralize the state. So it looked like centralized Unitarianism have been developed in this Burman heartland. But if we take a look at the frontier area, we might see the variety of sovereignty along the borderline. Sometimes you can see the confederalist system, which is another story from federalism, such as AA, Arakan Army, has already proclaimed that confederalism might be suitable for Rakhine State rather than federalism. Okay, and for the northern part of Chan State, the Palong movement, the Gokang movement, or even the Wa movement, it seems that their governing system or structure look like the loosely confederalist system. That is another story from the concept about federalism. Okay, but for the Kachin people led by KIA or KIO, for the Kayin and Kaya people led by KNU, KNPP, and so on and so forth, or the Chin movement, all of this represents democratic federation. They want to establish the genuine federal democracy or democratic federation. So quite different from Arakan Army or even UWSA and their ethnic alliance. And NUG government would like to establish federal democracy. Okay, so I think there are three types of governing structure in Myanmar today: centralized Unitarianism, federalism, and some kind of confederalism. So Myanmar is the combination of three types of governing formats. So how to design federalism systematically and can address the root cause in this country, the long-standing conflict and confrontation, I think we need to think about theoretical concept beyond the true concept of federalism. We need to think about confederalism, autonomous region, highland autonomy, and something like that. So it is rather difficult. But I think for the first step, just try to invite or convince various political adversaries to sit together in the peace process and say something about designing the state. Some idea about confederalism, federalism, Unitarianism would be welcome. And we will design again step by step based on the systematic peace building.
The previous attempts during the transition period to bring different parties to the table, iron out a deal and hammer it out, is widely seen as a failure. And we've spoken to many Burmese democratic leaders and activists who have expressed a desire to not have the next iteration copy in the same failures as the previous one. And so, as you say just now, that there needs to be an ability to bring parties together and talk to them. I'm curious to hear what you feel are the failures as to why the last round didn't work and how to approach this time differently in a way that won't repeat what didn't work last time.
When we talk about the peace process in Myanmar, there is a combination between progress and stagnation. When we look at Teng Seng administration, that was the golden age for the peace talks and the peace process. And the concrete outcome is the Nationwide Ceasefire Agreement, NCA, in 2015. And under NLD administration, led by Daw Aung San Suu Kyi, the big conference, the 21st Century Panglong Union Peace Conference, was very impressive. Many political stakeholders come together, talk and discuss about democratic federation together in the peaceful manner. So I think this is the very powerful macro event in the peace process. But everything has been changed since senior General Min Aung Hlaing decide to control the state and bring the state to the political unstable condition with the civil war again. So now it is the time to think about how to establish federalism in the context of the re-emergence of the peace process and the upcoming election. Despite the fact that the Tatmadaw represents authoritarianism, represents the big problem for federalization. But by the end of this year until early next year, the Tatmadaw has already set up the roadmap for democratizing process by having the election. Despite the fact that this election is problematic, but it can pave the way for the more democratizing process, and many political stakeholders can come again, sit in, exchange some idea about how to design federalism for this country. So Min Aung Hlaing have already set up democratic roadmap, and we do hope that at least the partial peace process can emerge and develop. Not nationwide peace process, but the partial peace can be possible. But at the same time, some ethnic armed organizations led by the Restoration Council of Chan State, by General Yeosuk, he tried to convince 17 ethnic armies, including NUG representatives, to sit together in another circle or forum for designing federalism. So 17 ethnic armies, including PDF, can come together and having some agenda for designing federalism. This is another progress in the peace process.
So you mentioned the election as being problematic. I think some would say that's a quite an understatement to say that it's problematic. There's a great fear that the military is going into a rigged sham to be able to further cement their legitimacy and hold on the country when, you know, it's a so-called election where, you know, such a small percentage of the country is actually held by them, and so many groups are either choosing not to participate because they don't believe it's fair, or banned from participating, or many of them just having already been killed or still in prison. And so there is a great push by the resistance movement, the democratic movement, to want to call out this election and not participate, not see it as anything but what it is, not bring any legitimacy to it, and to really push that narrative of what a fake spectacle this is. But as you describe it, you know, you identify that it's problematic, but it sounds like you also see this problematic event as something that could create an opening of some kind as well. If I understand that correctly, can you expand on that?
What What I would like to emphasize here is the possibility for having the election. The election can be held. Let me explain a little bit. I think there might be two scenarios for this upcoming election. The first one, there are totally 330,000 chips, the origin of parliamentary system in Myanmar. Okay. If the Tatmadaw can have the election more than 200 townships, they can open the parliament and choose the new president and set up the new cabinet so that they can administrate the country, led by USDP party and some ethnic party combining as the coalition government. But one of the most challenging issues is Min Aung Hlaing would like to be the president or not. If he wants to be the president, he can do it. But opposition group will feel very dissatisfied. And the civil war will come again with the stronger power to fighting back with the Tatmadaw, aiming to eradicate the Tatmadaw, force the Tatmadaw to withdraw from politics.
Yeah.
Okay. But there is another tactic. Min Aung Hlaing might not become the president, but he can choose someone at his proxy to govern the state. And he can command and control behind the scene. And he might be still the commander-in-chief of the defense service, or finding someone else to be his proxy to control not only governmental sector, but also the military sector. Okay. In this situation, the Praetorian transition or hybrid political regime can be workable. The opposition group might want to fight back with the military, but not the higher degree, because they might satisfy with political transition, hybrid political regime, not genuine democracy, but it is better than before. And Min Aung Hlaing step back behind the scene. Okay. However, there is another serious scenario. And I think if this scenario can emerge and develop, the Tatmadaw will be in a very difficult situation. That is, NUG government with ethnic armed organization have tried again to fight back with Myanmar military, and then they extend liberated zones and establishing the new capital like Mandalay, Magway, or other city, having the new seat of power for NUG government in the land of Myanmar.
Mm.
So the politics of Myanmar will be polarized.
Yes.
One with new seat of power by NUG government. Another one is Naypyidaw. So this is the real contestation in the long-standing civil war. And if opposition group can do this job, I think the roadmap for democratization, the roadmap for Praetorian transition by Min Aung Hlaing will be in a difficult problem. So I think, but when I evaluate every factors, I think this kind of scenario is rather difficult to emerge.
Yes.
But it is possible in some way.
It's very fascinating, and I agree that it's a very interesting scenario, but I think it unfortunately also assumes a mature level of geostrategic thinking that we have not seen a shred of with the NUG to date, and as well as the cooperation at higher levels. And I want to unpack one of the terms you're using, because you're talking about a hybrid regime, and we had a conversation some years ago with Roger Lee Huang, who wrote a fascinating book. And we talked about his work and his argument being that the transition period was never a democratization. It was never a liberalization. It was a hybrid regime of the military being, you know, remarkably consistent in doing what it said it was going to do, and its actions mirroring and aligning what it was saying, and that being that it was actually safer for them to continue their control and their rule by relieving some pressures, not ever meant to to lead to any kind of full-scale democratization, but as a way to have a hybrid, to have a hybrid regime of authoritarian control with some liberal openings that, in their view, hopefully would not come to threaten it. And there are threads and precedents of this, even in the most totalitarian of times. If you look at like the work of Jared McCarthy and, you know, where civil society over the years or Elliott Prosser Freeman, you know, where elements of civil society has been allowed to come. You know, I remember my conversation with Roger Lee Huang. He says, you know, I've always pushed back against this idea that that civil society wasn't allowed to flourish, because there's many examples of civil society flourishing. And, you know, it also called the question, is civil society always a progressive element? Because when you allow greater freedoms, they can also go in extremist positions. And so to unpack that term and then look at and then bring our listeners back to what you just said, that you're looking at kind of the contrast or the direct conflict of these two systems head to head, the military's, you know, at best hybrid, at worst total totalitarian and exploitative model, and then on the other side, the dreams and aspirations, the vague and messy and as yet undefined dreams of what some version of a federal democracy would look like. So, would you say that this is an accurate ideological battleground of ideas that we're seeing right now?
Yes. When we talk about political regime in the world or in particular region, we might often see that there is the big polarization between democracy and authoritarianism. Two types of political regime, these two types cannot coexist, cannot live together. They are polarized. Mm-hmm. But in many countries around the world, there is a hybrid regime in which democracy and authoritarianism can coexist. Mm-hmm. For example, in the case of Singapore and Cambodia, we can see general election, we can see democratic institution, but at the same time, we can see the leadership authoritarian style. Hun Sen used power in authoritarian manner, but he come from general election. He come from general election. In Singapore, the People Party, the PPT, the governmental party come from general election. And Singapore is a high developmental state. But at the same time, there might be some authoritarian style in governing structure. Okay, so this represents hybrid political regime. In the case of Myanmar, military authoritarianism is very powerful in Myanmar politics and society. But finally, the Tatmadaw decided to transform the full military authoritarianism to a more democratizing process, but with the condition that the military still play the leadership role in politics. This kind of explanation represents hybrid political regime. Myanmar has democratic institution, the Lutdo, the upper house, the lower house, the general election, but the military still play very powerful role in politics. So let me recall the wording by senior General Tan Chui. In 2010, he proclaimed that he wanted to see Myanmar as the flourishing disciplined democracy. This represents hybrid political regime. He wants to see a more democratizing process, but the Tatmadaw can still command and control the whole political landscape, because in this country, democracy might be valuable in some way, but at the same time, the role of military is quite important as well, because Myanmar has long-standing civil war, political disorder. In order to have order or ordering power, the emergence of Tatmadaw is important. That is why he emphasized the flourishing disciplined democracy. And I evaluate that senior general Min Nong Lai might think about this kind of concept, the Praetorian transition with hybrid political regime. So in the upcoming election, he wants to see the coalition government led by USDP and other ethnic party And without the landslide victory by opposition group, NLD has already been boycotted or expelled from this upcoming election. And the 2008 constitution still remains, so that the Myanmar military power in politics still remains as well.
Yeah. I think one of the strange similarities that other guests on this platform have commented in contrasting the military with the NLD is that at top elite levels, whether it's democratic or military leader, there has been a distrust and a discomfort and suspicion with really giving too much preference or power to the people. Even with NLD leadership, there were signs that that you couldn't quite trust the people to lead them to make the decisions, and they had to have a strong leader to be able to follow in their suit. And so, you know, those democratic leanings of or suspicions that have still characterized, at least up until the coup, Myanmar society, I think that's one concerning issue that one can call upon. I think, you know, just as we spoke about how there could be a hesitation that the NUG would have the mature strategic ability to set up a bifurcated capital and system of control, I would also call the question, does Min Aung Hlaing and his leadership have the strategic brilliance of, you know, past Than Shwe or Ne Win, who, you know, really, really knew exactly where to play the cards and how to keep control? Does he really have that same strategic outlook to be able to set up a hybrid regime and to see the advantage of that? And then the corollary of that question would be, if he were to do that, which again, I haven't really seen any signs of that strategic thinking taking place to date. There has been such a consistent call among the opposition and resistance groups that this is the last fight. I mean, it has been such a profound statement of, you know, we have this cancer in our society. We have these murderers, these rapists, these extortionists, these terrorists, these mafia outfit that have been destroying our lives. There cannot be any more compromise with them. It is conjuring up their words, this sense that it is beyond the pale for the international community to be telling us that we need to sit down with our murderers, our rapists, you know, our terrorists, and to make peace with them and trust them in going forward. They need to be wiped out. And so these are two pretty profound conditions to take place. First, for Min Aung Hlaing or advisors or leadership under him to see the value in genuinely implementing a hybrid regime that's something of a transition 2.0. And then two, in the opposition groups in having, even if that were done, and it were done legitimately, as legitimately as a hybrid regime could be, it feels like it'd be a stretch for a lot of the resistance groups to want to enter into that kind of agreement. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's quite interesting. I think we need to understand elite and mass relationship, because for political transformation, democratic transformation, it can be driven by elite decision-making process and their strategy. And the key concept is political reform. For example, Myanmar has had hybrid political regime in 2011 under Teng Seng administration. And Teng Seng is the representative from hybrid political regime, but there was the big progress in the peace process. There was the big political reform in Myanmar politics and society at that time. So Teng Seng personal charisma is very impressive. But comparing to NLD led by Aung San Suu Kyi, despite the fact that Aung San Suu Kyi won the landslide victory in the 2015 general election, but Aung San Suu Kyi leadership style is specific. Ethnic armed organizations, some of them used to complain that dealing with Teng Seng is smooth, convenient, comfortable, comparing to talking with Aung San Suu Kyi. Yeah. It seemed that she had some confidence in her decision-making process. I think the source of democratization, NLD government is in the better position comparing to USDP government led by Teng Seng administration. But for the art of peacemaking, it seems that Teng Seng administration is in the upper hand comparing to NLD administration. And another one is, I already mentioned about the key concept of the reform command and control by political elite. They want to change political landscape, but step by step and in the way that they can control the whole political scenario.
Right.
But that kind of democratic trajectory is not sufficient for the big change in democratization process. It is necessary but not sufficient for establishing the genuine democracy. So there is another keyword that is revolution. Now, NUG government opposition group need to have revolutionary war against military dictatorship. Only in this condition that the Tatmadaw need to be forced to withdraw from politics, or the Tatmadaw have been destroyed totally, we can see the genuine democracy. And if we take a look at many cases around the world, right, Arab Spring, political change in some part of Europe and Asia, they move by revolutionary war for getting the genuine democracy, not by the reform process driven by elite.
That seems to almost contradict what you said earlier. Yeah. So how do we square those away?
Rather difficult to explain. Yeah. And what do you think about this?
I'm reflecting on what you said a bit ago about distinguishing between the masses and the elite, and I have a couple of thoughts about that. The first question is, okay, who are the elite this time? I mean, obviously it was Aung San Suu Kyi and her entourage before, but who are the elite this time that have that kind of ability, that kind of respect, that kind of leadership? Simply, who is that? Is the first question. And the second question, or statement, or reflection, is that there was a very significant, and to some degree still is, although not as much, absolute cult worship of Aung San Suu Kyi. I mean, she's a democratic icon. She was a Burmese figure on the world stage. People would walk over, you know, hot coals for her. They would they completely fell in line with her leadership and her thoughts and as she proceeded. For the most part, there has been a profound shift in the last 5 years among the Burmese populace, especially the youth, who are making some of the greatest sacrifices. That there is a certain kind of independent spirit and thought and confidence in themselves that is not going to simply bow down, I don't think, and do what an elite says and trust those words of the elite in kind of a more traditional way. There's a lot of norms that have been broken, whether they're norms of, in a Buddhist sense, of lay monastic relationships and the way the Sangha has played a role in a very kind of complicated and nuanced way that it's various aspects of the Sangha have interacted or not interacted with different parts of the military and the opposition. But certainly we've seen those fissures in the way that there's been public criticism of Sidi Useida and other prominent monks, as well as of democracy, former great democracy icons like Aung San Suu Kyi and other NLD leadership. And so I think, you know, a corollary of that question of, okay, who are the elites, is even if one could be identified, which would, you know, certainly not have the cachet of former leaders in that position, this youth generation is doing a lot to create their own civic spaces and their own independent thought that I don't think would just easily fall into being swayed by saying, okay, sir, okay, ma'am, yes, we'll go ahead and do this. That there are certain things that they are fighting for, they are sacrificing, and they want. And how that all shapes up, I mean, how far one is willing to keep up the struggle and how difficult it's become, that is a fair question. But I think that it's not a matter of just falling in line in the way that happened in previous iterations.
Yeah. Because Myanmar current political landscape is very complicated, it is rather difficult to identify the actual elite or political leaders in this country. But for the Burman heartland under military or totalitarianism, it is sure that Min Aung Hlaing is number one and So Win is number two. And if there might be the upcoming election in December this year and January next year, the head of USDP party will become the new leader, the head of the USDP party. But at the same time, Min Aung Hlaing can still be the powerful person in front of or behind the scene. But officially, for the next president, for the next leader inside the cabinet in Myanmar, most of them might come from USDP. Okay, and for opposition group, NLD Aung San Suu Kyi has already been excluded from this upcoming electoral politics. So Aung San Suu Kyi is in a difficult situation to become the strong leader again, due to many limitations from her side and her political party, which has already been disbanded by the Electoral Commission. But if we look at NUG political structure, we can find some leaders or some elites. The head of NUG government, who come from the Kachin state, is the official leader from NUG government. But there are several PDF, with several local elites who command, who govern in East Liberated Zones, in East PDF headquarters, many fragmented. So there is no single command from NLD government to control every PDF unit. But at least in past, NUG government has the Ministry of Defense, and they also have the head of the Ministry of Defense. This is another key figure who can control the scatter of fragmented PDF, that despite the fact that it is very hard for them to control them in a single command.
To some extent, although I would push back that I've had so many conversations with activists, with resistance leaders, general strike committees, PDF leaders, normal PDFs, ethnic fighters, and a consistent thing that has come up in so many of these interviews is that when I reference something about NUG and their thoughts or relations to it, there's almost like this this look of shock or confusion on their face, in the sense of, and if I were to unpack that, their look seems to be, why are you bringing up something so irrelevant? You know, what does this have to do with what I'm talking about? And as we go in, that's kind of the answer they give, is that we've moved on. It's not worth our time to criticize it anymore. We don't believe that we can that we can get through to them. We don't believe we can have effective communication or conversation. And so and we don't want to criticize them, one, because we don't think it will actually be effective, and two, because it will it'll be kind of airing dirty laundry to the international community we don't want to do. So we just leave it aside. We know who they are, we know what they do. We've let go of our disillusionment and our frustration. We're just focused on, you know, IDP camps or this PDF battalion or, you know, this region that is undergoing these kinds of problems. And so, you know, so many that I've talked to have really moved on from that. Some, you know, some PDFs might have some limited interaction with some elements of NUG, but there's certain, you know, it's kind of like, what exactly is NUG providing? You know, what exactly are they doing that those PDFs on the ground are not? And so, you know, what I'm really struck by when I have those conversations, especially when they're with people on the border or in the country, is just to whatever degree they are focused on what they are doing. And those outside issues of NUG or international politics or elections or everything else, they're it's kind of like, let those fall into where they are. We are doing this. And then when you go on and ask the next question, they will say, we will, myself and no one around me will accept a reality where, you know, this is the case or this is the case or this is happening. We have fought too hard. We have lost too much. We have a clear vision that it has to be somewhat aligned with what we're looking for. And again, that's not to say they're going to entirely get their way, or that's going to be a steadfast conviction that they have, you know, they've had 5 years, they have 10 years or 15 years. That's all to question. But just to indicate, you know, to what degree the NUG is becoming irrelevant for so many of these ground actors, and to what degree their own civic space and agency has informed them in ways that we've not seen in past generations.
Yes, I totally agree with you.
And I'm recalling, I had this really interesting interaction when I was in Mesot last time. I met these three American former U.S. Army guys that had come to Mesot. They wanted to film a documentary about the conflict and bring it back to American audiences, and they were new to Myanmar physically. They'd never been to Southeast Asia before. Mm. They did not come completely unawares. They had been watching YouTube videos and trying to read books and listen to our podcasts and, you know, read articles. Kind of, they had not actually been in touch with people in a physical way, but they had heard a lot of information. So they were not novices. They had been spending years getting themselves acquainted with the understanding of the situation, but they did not have ground experience. And that's an important forewarning for kind of building the context for this question they asked me, which was so fascinating. Because at one point, one of them turned to me and he said, can you help explain something to me? We're hearing these two strains of thoughts and we can't put them together. On one hand, everyone in this resistance community is telling us how important NUG is, how they need to have legitimacy, how we can't do it without them, how they need to be accepted and recognized by the international community and the significance. And then we're hearing this other strand where they can't be depended on, you can't do anything with them, they're irrelevant, everything we do needs to be outside their structure. So they asked me, how can you square away these two simultaneous beliefs that they're super important and need to be recognized and need legitimacy, but they're inefficient, ineffective, and can't be relied on for anything? And you know, I said, well, welcome to Myanmar.
Yeah. And I would like to add one point about the role of American in Myanmar politics. I suggest to look at Myanmar in the context of international system, and the model of international system can pave the way for our clearer understanding about the relationship between major powers and Myanmar. For talking about the world order, there are three or four types: unipolar system, bipolar system, and multipolar system. Myanmar should be analyzed within this framework. Firstly, I strongly believe that Myanmar has been under a unipolar system led by the domination of China. China's sphere of influence is quite strong in Myanmar. China would like to access to the Andaman Sea or the Bay of Bengal via Myanmar. And China Belt and Road Initiative have passed through many strategic areas in Myanmar. So Myanmar is under Chinese sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. That is a true story if we take a look at the Northern Chan State or some part of Kachin State. But there is another world order system in Myanmar. And now that kind of system has emerged and developed. I think it looked like the bipolar system between American power under Trump administration, who want to re-engage with Min Aung Hlaing. And Min Aung Hlaing wants someone to support his democratic roadmap in by the end of this year. And re-engagement with Donald Trump might have some benefits for the junta, at least its image in international society. And if Donald Trump, under the Indo-Pacific strategy, would like to compete with China in this area, the White House need to think about coming to Myanmar to counter back with Chinese sphere of influence. But there is another scenario, that is the multipolar system. China still become the dominant player in Myanmar international and internal politics. USA is another one, but Moscow is another one as well, because the close relationship between the Tatmadaw and Russian armed forces and Moscow nuclear development process in Tajinayi region in Myanmar is another interesting issue that need to be taken into account. We also think about the role of India, South Korea, and particularly my country, Thailand, as another key role player in Myanmar political transformation process. So the multipolar system in connection with Myanmar political transformation is quite clear for today. And I strongly believe that when we need to choose between unipolar system led by China, bipolar system, or multipolar system, I think Myanmar is a critical juncture that these three types of world order mix together. And we are not sure whether Myanmar will move to that kind of the particular world order system. We are not sure, but I think three main scenario is quite important.
Yeah, and of course, Myanmar has always been fiercely independent, not wanting to be anyone's puppet throughout history, and verging towards xenophobia. So certainly, you know, they would not like to be seen in the pocket of China. But I want to pull on one thing that you mentioned in what you just said, and that's you had referenced Russia's nuclear arms program in relation to Myanmar. Can you tell us more about how Myanmar is related to that?
I would like to turn back to Myanmar under SPDC or Tan Choy administration. At that time, there was the big concerns about American-Myanmar conflict and confrontation under George W. Bush and Tan Choy at that time. And Myanmar military decided to move the capital to Naypyidaw and set up the new underground complex with technicians from North Korea and Russia. Taught them about nuclear weapon, nuclear development, ballistic missile, underground warfare, and so on and so forth. And at that time, the Tatmadaw decided to set up the nuclear battalion at the specific unit for defending the country, and also send Myanmar soldiers to join educational class in Moscow and St. Petersburg. So military training forming from Moscow and St. Petersburg to Myanmar paved the way for the specific strategic relations between these two countries.
Yeah.
And for the weapon sophistication system, it seems that Myanmar soldiers feel satisfied or impressive with Moscow weapon system rather than Beijing weapon system. So MiG-29 airstrike operation coming from the hell of Moscow. So for military might, military power of the Myanmar soldier, it has to depend on Moscow.
Right, and then another threat in there that you mentioned is the role that your country, Thailand, is playing. So I'd like to get your views on Thai-Burmese relations over the years and today, and also where ASEAN fits into that.
We also have the rhetoric about fighting with the Burmese coming from the fall of Ayutthaya, our ancient capital, destroyed by the Burmese soldier in the past. So the Thai nationalism focus on fighting against the Burmese, even though in the present day, from the Cold War politics until today, some key figures or political leaders in Thai military organization still have some thought about viewing Myanmar as a great enemy,
yeah,
coming from the bad history of warfare between the two countries in the past. But for today, I think everything has been changed, not totally, but partially. We are now in the new rhetoric about Myanmar. We move from fighting against the Burmese into helping the Burmese people because of the long-standing civil war in Myanmar, because of political fragmentation in Myanmar, and many Myanmar people need to have more help from neighboring countries. And the role of Thailand is quite important because if we try to increase our power, our image in international society. Humanitarian diplomacy is important for the Thai role, the Thai foreign policy orientation. That is one of the main reasons to explain our rhetoric has been changed partly from fighting against Myanmar into helping the Myanmar people.
What role do you think that Thailand could or should be playing at this current time with a conflict raging on its very long border with Myanmar and having the effects of that implications coming into Thai soil really on an everyday basis for the past 5 years in a multitude of ways?
We share border with Myanmar, the land border around 2,400 kilometers with security complexities, with drug trafficking, with human trafficking, with bodily dispute in many strategic areas. So we have to prepare for our systematic defense policy and foreign policies regarding to Myanmar state and society. We have to understand that in the border area, the political landscape is fairly complicated. Not only the Tat Mador authority in many military camps, but also the authority from NUG government and ethnic armed organizations like RCSS, UWSA, KNPP, KNU. We need to remap political landscape in Myanmar and redrawing our political mapping in relation with Myanmar. That is very important for protecting the Thai national interest. But we can also do something to increase our image in international society and helping the Myanmar people. The first one is under Set Thathawisin administration with Pan Pi as the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Thailand used to be conducted a humanitarian corridor by setting up Mesot Mewadi as the important gateway for running humanitarian aid inside the land of Myanmar. We also have to initiate some peace talk, the partial peace talk, by convincing representatives of ethnic armed organizations along Thai-Myanmar borderline to sit together and have the common objective about how to pacify the border in order to protect the Thai interests, because we invest a lot along the borderline. We invest a lot along some regions and states in Myanmar. We used to convince some of political adversary and stakeholder to sit together. This is the role of Thailand. But for the current Thai-Cambodian conflict, everything has been changed. The focus to the Western neighboring country has been changed to the Eastern border. Ministry of Defense, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, National Security Council, the three main organizations in setting Thai strategic policy orientation towards neighboring country. Now everything need to focus on Cambodian conflict. So the role of Thailand for Myanmar upcoming election, for Myanmar peace process, is rather limited, because we need to focus on Cambodia as the first priority.
Right. And so then moving from Thailand to ASEAN, we're seeing a shift in the chair from Malaysia to Philippines. What did you think of the role and the work of Malaysia as the ASEAN seat for 2025? And what are your thoughts on what Philippines might do and what, assuming that we have some listeners in Manila that are tuned into this, what kinds of advice or what would you like to see from them as they take it on?
The role of Malaysia is quite outstanding, led by Anwar Ibrahim. But in this December, Malaysia need to transfer many authority to the Philippines so that the Philippines can become the new chairman of ASEAN next year. So ASEAN is in the transitional period from changing position from Malaysia to the Philippines. But the Philippines has limited knowledge about mainland Southeast Asia, or even maritime Southeast Asia, because the Philippine location is quite far away from the zone of conflict in Myanmar, Thailand, and Cambodia. But it is not so different comparing to Malaysia, because Malaysia is situated in maritime Southeast Asia, and Malaysian's government might have limited knowledge about Indo-Chinese Peninsula for addressing some problem between Thailand and Cambodia. Perhaps Vietnam has more knowledge about Indo-Chinese affairs comparing to Malaysia. But let's have some point about Myanmar politics, Myanmar upcoming election. I think the Philippines as the new chairman of ASEAN can have some role for resolving conflict in Myanmar. But at least just bringing ASEAN five-point consensus back in and try to push some point in this consensus for helping the Myanmar people for the cessation of violence, that would be enough for ASEAN, because ASEAN cannot do any more, because the politics of Myanmar not only depends on ASEAN, but also depend on India, China, other neighboring countries, other major power in global politics, or even North Korea and Russia. That is why ASEAN has limited role for dealing with conflict or long-standing civil war in Myanmar. So we need to have a new model that is the combination between the friend of Myanmar, the neighboring country all around Myanmar, and many members in ASEAN, and also USA and other European countries should have should come to sit together and share something about how to resolve conflict in Myanmar.
It would be great, but with the breakdown of global order and competing crises that we're seeing in the world today, as well as with the lessening influence and, lesser motivation and activity that we're seeing of international organizations like the United Nations, that feels like great advice that would be like some of the other great advice you've shared today. It seems like it might be hard to find its way to reality.
Yes, I also agree with this.
Well, I thank you so much for coming on and joining this conversation. So much more we could go to, but being conscious of your time and hoping to invite you at a follow-up at some point, I'd like to thank you for coming and sharing all these views.
Thank you so much for your kind invitation. And I think we have a rather fruitful conversation about Myanmar politics. What I would like to say to the audience is the significance of Myanmar in many respects. Myanmar is one of the most important countries for our educational development about area study or regional study or in internal and international politics. When we talk about hybrid political regime, when we discuss about federalism building, state building project, or the relationship between warfare and state building, the relationship between democracy and federalization, all of this significance appear in Myanmar case. So Myanmar case is very fascinating, specific in the literature of political science and social sciences. So let's try to understand Myanmar again and again, because it is the fascinating case study for our society. And I feel very happy that Inside Myanmar podcast conversation can greatly contribute to the accumulation of this valuable knowledge about Myanmar politics, society, and Myanmar in other aspects. Very impressive. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. Producing these conversations takes dedication and resources. And through this process, we're committed to keeping all these episodes freely available for everyone well into the future. But to really make this work sustainable, we do need your help.
If you've enjoyed this episode or found it valuable, and if you listen to our platform on any somewhat regular basis, we ask you to consider supporting us with a recurring donation. It doesn't have to be much. Think of it as, I don't know, buying us a cup of coffee each month. That small gesture of committing to just $5 per month can make a big difference in helping us to continue bringing you these stories. And if you're feeling a bit more generous, increasing the monthly pledge will allow us to produce even more on our end. In the end, any level of support goes directly towards amplifying the voices and stories that matter. This not only keeps us going, but also ensures that these important conversations reach more people around the world. To make a contribution, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation or look for Insight Myanmar on PayPal or Patreon.
Yarananga yaunya na dadu ya dana biori ganeza de mana we gara besayana besayo hoba yarananda dayana nangana yarananya dayana nampoda ba yarananda